Good afternoon. I'd like to call a meeting of the House Resource Committee together at 1:01 p.m. We are in room 124. Today is Monday, March the 16th, 2015. Our members present are Representative Josephson, Representative Herron, Representative Seaton, Representative Tarr, our Vice Chair, Representative Hawker, Co-Chair, Representative Nagiak, and myself, Co-Chair, Representative Tallarico. So I'd like to let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. I would also like to recognize our staff today. Our recording secretary is Chris Jones. Thank you very much. And our teleconference aide is Jessica Honlin. Thank you, Jessica. The committee aide is Gary Zepp from Representative Nagiak's office. Gary is right there. And Julie Morris from my office. Julie's right here. If you have need of anything during the meeting, please get their attention and they will assist you. I'd like to ask everyone to please silence your cell phones now during the course of the meeting. And today we have two confirmation hearings before the committee. The commissioner designee for the Department of Natural Resources, Mr. Mark Myers, and the commissioner designee for the Department of Fish and Game, Mr. Sam Cotton. So I'm wondering if we could get and request that Mr. Myers please come forward.
Mr. Chair? No, but I'm not going to make the motion to move him out. I'll give you, but Ms. Lincoln, Mr. Chair, I have a bill up in another committee at 1:30, so unfortunately I'll have to be leaving here somewhere along the way, but I definitely want to express my endorsement to moving both of these candidates onto the floor. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative Walker.
Dr. Myers.
Pardon me?
Dr. Myers.
Thank you for that correction. We appreciate that. So, Dr. Myers, for us to get started, if you'd like to give us any presentation, any information, we know that you've been in front of us before and spoken to all of us before, and we appreciate your previous appearances as well. But if you could give us a little bit of background information, that would be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's an honor to be here, first of all, to have this opportunity to represent the state as Commissioner of Natural Resources. Given the responsibility and the trust put in this office, I know you don't take it lightly, and I know I have to demonstrate my competency and capacity, so I just thank you for the opportunity to do that. I'll state that up front. And in order that, I think there's two things: background, history, character, and then a little bit about philosophy. I'd like to hit those things in a few minutes. So my background, I'm a kid from Wisconsin. I grew up in Wisconsin. I first came up to Alaska in 1974 with the university on a field trip, and I fell in love with the place doing geological field work in Alaska. To save money, I hiked the Chilkoot Trail to catch the ferry back home. It was a beautiful trip, and so from that point on, I wanted to come back to Alaska. I got several degrees from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in geology, went to work for oil company ARCO, with the goal, particularly chose that oil company because it would send me back to Alaska. And so my first assignment, of course, then actually went to Louisiana, so which was a great experience. I met my wife there, Alice, who we've been married for more than 30 years. We have two children. I have a son studying physics, sophomore studying physics, and a daughter working in a graduate program in music. So I'm very fortunate. Had a wonderful life. My wife, today, she can't be here, but she's an ice Alaskan, Fairbanks, working at the snack bar, volunteering at the snack bar.
All right. I'd like to recognize that Representative Johnson has joined us. And I guess none of us get to go to the snack bar today. I'd like to.
Well, if you get a chance to go to ice Alaska, it's amazing. In Fairbanks. So that said, I first got to Alaska in 1983, worked for ARCO, worked on exploration, frontier exploration in many of the basins, including the offshore Beaufort Sea, Navarin, Norton Sound, other areas. Then switched over to development and worked the early development of Kaparik Field, where I was responsible for two-thirds of the development, two-thirds of the field's development geology going up there. I decided to go back and get a PhD degree. I did that, and then I went to work for the state of Alaska about 8 years as a petroleum geologist. I then went back to industry. I felt excited about some of the new advances in 3D seismic technology. And with a PhD in the area, my expertise in classic sedimentology, was able to work on several new discoveries. I had lot of exploration of wells where I was the principal geologist and actually two discoveries. I then was approached to consider becoming director of oil and gas in the state by a bunch of people, and I agreed to do that. I spent 5 years doing that, and I quit in late November 2005 and got a call from the White House asking if I was also, for the last year of that time frame, the state geologist. So I was doing two divisions and I got a call from the White House asking if I consider being director of the U.S. Geological Survey in D.C. And first I thought it was a prank phone call, since I don't exactly have strong connections to the White House. It turned out they were serious, and after the vetting process, I was nominated and confirmed by the U.S. Senate as director of the survey, survey director from 2006 to 2009. Following that, a change of administration, a change of ideas and people, I came back to Alaska and spent about 2 years working as the AGEA coordinator for the state. I got a call from the university asking if I'd consider applying for a competitive position as vice chancellor of research. I said yes, and they ended up selecting me out of a national search. I spent the last 4 years prior to starting this job in January 2015 with the university. So through that process, I've also served 26 years in the Air Force Reserve as a pilot, but mostly as an intelligence officer, retiring as lieutenant colonel in 2003. So I've had the privilege of looking at resource issues from a very broad perspective, from a state, federal, private industry, oil and gas development in particular, and expertise, and I've been had a chance to lead some very large organizations. As a geologist, it's a thrill to be at the pinnacle position in the world for a geologist as director of the USGS. So it was quite an honor that I got to serve in that position. So I've managed organizations all the way from being a technical geologist working on development projects to a scientist, research scientist in the field. I spent 20 years of field work on the North Slope. To actually developing, getting my hands greasy and developing oil and gas fields. And so a lot of experience on that side. On the policy government side, run agencies as small as the Division of Oil and Gas with about 120 people. It's as large as USGS with 9,000 people, a budget of about $1.4 billion. So a lot of different experiences, a lot of exciting opportunities to serve in various capacities. In that process, I also testified many times in front of the legislature, but over, I think I stopped coming about 10 times of the U.S. Senate during the U.S. House. So experience to working in D.C. When I was serving as USGS director, I was a de facto science advisor for the Secretary of Interior. I also ran some very large organizations. My resume has some of the associations and organizations. Also, it's state technically accurate besides management. Currently, I serve on the National Petroleum Council along with Senator Stedman. I'm on the steering committee for the Arctic Study that will soon be released and will be presented up here in the first week of April. I serve on the Methane Hydrate Federal Advisory Committee trying to produce that resource, potential very, very large resource for the Secretary of the Energy. I also serve as a delegate to the Arctic Council Scientific Cooperation Task Force. So I'm one of five on a U.S. delegation that's negotiating a treaty for access to scientific access across the eight Arctic nations. So those are a few examples of the outside activities. There are many more listed here. So that's sort of my background experience. I love Alaska. We moved up in Alaska in 1983, so we have over 32 years of Alaska experience, with the exception of the 3 years or so in D.C. So that's me, PhD in geology. As I said, very specialized geologist, but also a lot of experience in managing resource issues and being exposed to, involved with complex resource issues, with all the challenges and opportunities that come with that. So 15 years in DNR. In that time frame as well, overall. So I actually started when I was working on PhD as a student intern at DNR, so it's kind of fun to go from the lowest to the highest position in the organization. So that's me. Philosophy really is about when I first started DNR as commissioner, I set four standards. The first was stewardship. DNR manages 160 million acres, but we don't own, as an individual, I don't own a share equal to every other Alaskan in those resources. So I have a responsibility to manage those resources on behalf of the people of Alaska. And there's a lot of diverse interests in that management, and there's a lot of need for managing effectively for the economy, economic development, sustainability for communities. So we have all these pieces that we have to put together to manage it carefully. So stewardship, first of all, what would you want this generation to receive out of it and future generations to receive? Very, very broad mandate. Incredible opportunity given our amazing resource holding. So the second is transparency. Because we're managing a public resource, being very, very transparent and open, and why we make decisions, how we make decisions, is crucial. There's no shorting the public process. It's expensive. It's challenging at times, but it's critical that people have trust in what we're doing. So the transparency of how and why we're making decisions based on science. That was my third leg of the stool. I'm a scientist. I really believe that science informs good decision-making, that science includes local and traditional knowledge, in my opinion, and it also includes traditional Western science. But that body of knowledge is critical for us to make these informed decisions, starting with a knowledge base, trying to bring alignment in that knowledge base, and then make the critical decisions. So science integrity is the last piece of it. If we don't have personal integrity, people don't trust us as leaders, then even with the best data and the best desires and goals, people will not trust the decision making. So those are the four legs of the stool that I believe are critical to managing the state resources. I also believe that in this time, we have a lot of dynamic changes going on. We've seen changes in the world oil market. We're also seeing changes in the environment. We're seeing increased coastal erosion. We're seeing thermokarsting. We're seeing isostatic rebound, land growing. I mean, we live in a very dynamic world. So managing that effectively involves understanding those changes, understanding these changes in the economy, and managing adaptively. So I'm a strong believer in an adaptive management approach where we can set standards, but we have to monitor for change and adjust to those changes on time. Otherwise, we are paralyzed by uncertainty. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I think I'll open it up to any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Dr. Meyer. We appreciate that. Committee members, do you have any questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, and you know, I appreciated interacting with you in the past in the state. Would you please discuss the mission of the department as it was established in statute when the legislature established the department and where the mission is currently?
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Let me pull out my notes to get the exact phrasing of the current mission statement, which I have not changed, but I have a group starting to work on reviewing the current mission statement. So the mission statement is to responsibly develop Alaska's resources by making them available for the maximum use and benefit consistent with the public interest. Now, historically, that has included, I've looked at the mission statements going back about, you know, probably 10 commissioners worth. They typically have to develop, conserve and develop, or protect and develop, some theme about resource management. It's not purely development in them. You know, Commissioner Sullivan probably understanding what was happening with future oil prices and realized that, you know, really to push the maximum, develop the maximum use consistent with public benefit, which is a less balanced public statement. I believe that the conserve piece of it is important as well. It's not preservationist, but it's a balancing. It's truly a balancing of our resource needs. That said, we are an economy which is dependent on resources development on our public lands. If you look at it, the DNR job, one of the reasons it's so challenging is that it is the economic engine for the state. Almost all activities that occur in the state occur on 160 million acres. Very little is occurring on federal lands now, as we know, other than tourism and some ecosystem services that are provided by the system. More and more, also the native corporations, 44 million acres are being used for development, but much of that land isn't going to bring in high revenue. So when you look at it, the state's resources are the economic engine. Along with that, there's a timing and a balance, fish versus oil and gas, for example, maximizing good regulatory structures so you can preserve the renewable resources while you develop the non-renewable resources is critical. So we have to be balanced in the way we approach things and understand those risks. And again, that's why the four pillars I talked about are so important to that decision.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And I appreciate that, and I appreciate you looking at that mission statement, which in the past also included for future Alaskans or future generations. But I guess my concern is that we as a legislature established a department with a statutory mission statement. And I'm wondering how you, as an as a member of the executive, feel about going out and establishing a different mission for the department. Now, I know we gave you authority to do for divisions and subdivisions their missions, but the executive going in and changing the statutory mission statement, and I'd like to, you to discuss that balance.
So, you know, I've asked, Representative Seaton to the chair, I've asked for legal advice on the issue, first of all, and I've also asked internally for us to start looking at what a new mission statement might look like. Again, every commissioner has modified it slightly. So in both cases, you know, my goal was, regardless of whether I had the right to, I wanted to come back to the legislature. It is clearly, we work under a series of laws that are created, statutes that are created by the legislature, and my job is to honor those statutes and regulations. So with that said, I would not change it personally without going back to the legislature and asking, which is why I haven't done anything with the current mission statement, other than have us look at it in terms of the balance. You know, I think in practical nature, the DNR management is pretty darn consistent in terms of the goals and needs and responsibilities and the statutory and regulatory structure. I think it varies in terms of somewhat with the public process that's used and how much public process is used and the balancing pieces of it over time. And obviously, commissioners have different personalities, but what's driven, again, is really the mission of all the divisions and the imperative that we have a sustainable development, long-term sustainable development in the state, but we also preserve those values and provide resources for communities as well. So there's a, you know, really a balancing of missions when you look at it. You know, there are four core services. If you'd allow me, I could go through those, and I think those very much reflect what the department does, maybe more so than the mission statement does. And those are to foster responsible commercial development and use of state land and natural resources consistent with the public interest for long-term wealth and employment, to mitigate threat to the public from natural disasters, natural hazards by providing comprehensive fire protection services on state, private, and municipal lands and through identifying significant geological hazards, provide access to state lands for public and private use, settlement, recreation, ensure sufficient data acquisition and assessment of land and resources to foster responsible resource and community development and public safety.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm pleased that if there's going to be changes, they'll come back to the legislature for that.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Representative Hawker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, Mark, it's good to have you in front of us again, as always. The prefacing observation to the question I want to ask is that you know, to me, as we review all of the designees and all of the confirmation requests that we have before the legislature, the single most important thing to me is whether an individual is professionally qualified for the job they're being placed to. And it doesn't matter whether Mr. Meyer's right. Over time, we've agreed on a lot of things, and we've disagreed on some things over time. And frankly, that's not relevant, because I'd just like to state for the record that I do not believe, as my 13 years in legislative history, that I have ever had anyone come before us for confirmation with as complete and appropriate professional a resume as Mr. Meyer brings before us. It's incredible how Mr. Meyer's qualifications just scream off the page. But I promised someone I'd use this word, but he's a rock licker. and by that I mean, you know, it's really in the realm of our oil and gas natural development that they're so incredibly qualified, in which it is 96%+ of our government economy here, which certainly says where I stand on Mr. Meyer. But I just, again, for the record of this committee and for, you know, my own comfort, Department of Natural Resources is a much broader topic. Managing the Department of Natural Resources is a much broader topic in the state than just, I'll use the word again, licking rocks. How do you intend to approach those other aspects of the department, those aspects with which you know, in all respect, may not be as familiar with as you are in the, you know, the incredible depth and breadth you bring to the geologic sciences?
Well, Representative Hawker, through the chair, again, thank you for those kind words. I really appreciate them. I have have had a lot of experience on the other sides of things. Being a vice chancellor researcher 4 years at the university, we did research in pretty much every area that DNR works. We had the cooperative extension in agriculture. I worked a lot on the water side with our water and environmental research center in the International Arctic, and the International Arctic Research Center, which also did a tremendous amount of work on water all the way from sea ice to glaciers and the Geophysical Institute. So I worked a lot on the water side. So water, ag, forestry, worked a lot through our forestry programs, our natural resource management programs, and the research that's actively going on at the university on forestries, on forest monitoring, remote sensing of forests, forest fire tools for forest firefighting, like the unmanned aerial vehicles systems were under me. So we get to forestry. With parks, we worked a lot on ecosystem-based areas of interest and preservation of environment, and not so much on tourism, but, for instance, a large grant that that I was the principal investigator on. Really, we're looking in the Kenai Peninsula. We're looking in Burns Bay area. We're looking on the North Slope near New Ixit to look at environmental change and sensitivities and how people perceive those changes and involve with the environment. So a lot of work crossing pretty much all the areas that DNR touches in terms of the R&D and the science and the data systems used for it, not so much on policy decisions, but information to inform those policies. At the USGS, you know, I had an agency that does far more than the rock-licking part. We did the water. We ran many of the national satellites, the Landsat satellites in particular. We did a tremendous amount of work on climate change research. In fact, I advocated for and got the new climate science centers. It was under my watch that those occurred. We provided much of the data that the world uses to manage its resources through Landsat. I worked with the Secretary of Interior and with the administration to release all our Landsat data for free. That data release led to 100 times increase in the use of that data. And there was a recent study that came out that showed that, a peer-reviewed study that showed that we actually are generating far more revenue in the private sector from that data and from the agency use than the whole program cost over its lifetime. That's because you're using it 100 times. It is the basis for Google Earth, et cetera. And when we released that data, they raided our servers, and they sucked every piece of information they could get out right away. So I understand these other areas. And again, if you look at Interior, it's really DNR is a mini version of the Department of Interior, by and large, without the fishing game, but with the forestry. So given that, I had a lot of exposure to all these other issues, water issues all over the country. The Secretary would bring me in personally on areas of water shortages and water management. Flint River Basin in Alabama, the Colorado River Basin, Puget Sound. So a lot of experience dealing with some of these hairy conflict issues in terms of science for ESA issues. So again, when we look at the circum, those years of experience were extremely valuable for me in broadening my scientific both capacity and knowledge base. And I basically got to learn from a lot of smart people that I worked with. So those other areas are very important. Land use management, economic development, conflict resolution are all critical pieces. The changing environment that I alluded to and working in adaptive management strategies are as necessary with water issues. Often the minimizing effect on resource development is a single other resource. For example, in many places, water is a limiting resource with respect to economic development, more so than is any other issue. Conflict on the landscape between cattle ranchers in the West and oil and gas developments is strong as between environmentalists and ESA. So bringing the parties together when you're working on these complicated issues up front. I think another thing I learned is often, you know, the permitting process is key, absolutely key to success. We know that. It's getting harder and harder to permit any project, and it is because of the legal and regulatory framework, but also the diverse amount of stakeholders that are involved in the process and the uncertainty inherent in the environmental change. So they say we have to go back and look at 100 years of data or 50 years of data. Or how far do you imagine this fish salmon moving up the stream? How far do you consider that for a bridge or a culvert? Do you consider it all the way to the ocean? You know, what's the coastal zone? And you go on in these kinds of issues. There needs to be a basic scientific data. There needs to be data gathered in front of the issue so you have good solid information going into it to limit those areas. And there has to be collaboration across the agencies and the organizations working on it. So in my experience, that is crucial, and I've had a lot of experience doing that. So I think the working with the university, the cat herding that goes on running the research at a research university, but also my work in the federal level across these agency boundaries really has helped me in those areas.
So, real quick follow-up.
Rep. Hocker.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. And I do, I've got my staff who just came to haul me away to another committee here. But I thank you for that. And my takeaway from all those words was that you are committing to us that you will be a science-based management kind of guy in this position.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Herron.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Meyer. And through the chair, you know, with your experience back in D.C. And especially with our current situation where the federal government, specifically the Department of the Interior, is trying to limit us, and as your job and this job, you're going to assist the governor and the legislature in trying to change that future. So what is it, I looked up one of your, you call it the long story of ANWR. What has the Department of Interior lost in that understanding of what ANWR means to the future of the United States and specifically Alaska? What have they forgotten or what have they ignored related to your essay?
I've risen here to the chair quite a lot, actually. I'll just say the first time I was asked to testify in Congress was about ANWR in 1995. So more than 20 years ago, I was asked to be the person that explained the resource potential in the reserves to ENR. Along the lines, I think, just a couple of observations. One is that Congress never made the final decision as to the 1002 area. Now, the rest of the refuge is 19 million acres, about 1.2 million acres, I believe, in the 1002 area. So a relatively small amount of the refuge, and obviously a relatively small amount, 8% of the refuge is at question for oil and gas development, and Congress never made the final decision. But it's Congress's decision to make. So the Department of Interior can manage the land to a certain standards, but they can't make that decision. That is reserved to Congress, and then the President can either veto it or approve it. And if it's vetoed, Congress can override it. So the history of the ANWR issue over time has been, realistically, let's get alignment to make that decision. And, of course, the state of Alaska obviously sees the resource potential. Again, the USGS, again, which I was director of, is the one that did the last resource assessment, professional resource assessment of ANWR. So in that role, there's a very large potential resource there. We don't know how much of it's there, but the numbers suggest a significant amount of hydrocarbons, mean case of about 10 billion barrels in the area. That's a huge amount of oil and gas. So then the question is, can it be developed without significant harm to wildlife? And I personally believe, looking at the tools, with good mitigation standards, with minimal impact, directional drilling, ice roads construction, it can be done successfully, and I've argued that fact many, many times in my career. So that said, the value of wilderness, if enacted, is a very different standard. Even you think about it, wilderness is a much more subjective standard. So what disturbs wilderness, you know, and how do you access wilderness? That is a very, I don't think there's any good science to say what that standard is or isn't. Whereas you can look at the effects on caribou and wildlife, you can't really look at it wilderness. It's the King Cove issue. Is one additional road in a very small refuge destroy the wilderness status? You can argue that. I think you cannot very successfully argue that it will have any significant effect on black rat. But I think you can argue that wilderness means don't touch it. So if that's the standard they're managing to it, it's something that clearly needs congressional approval. And they haven't got it. So I think there's a strong case for the state to argue that.
Just a follow-up related to your comments. Could you share with us your thoughts on this new label that the Interior is starting to use? They're trying to get away from that hot button word wilderness, and now what I'm hearing is that it's called landscape characteristics. Can you tell me why they're going to start using that? Is that to confuse people? Or do something worse?
Representative Hammond to the chair, it confuses me. As a scientist, I want specific terminology to mean something to be understood. A common definition is crucial to building a common resolution to any issue. You have to have the same definitions and the same terminology, and they have to be understood by the parties, right? That's what lawyers get paid a lot of money to argue over if you don't have. So with that construct, new categorizations ought to be clearly defined. They all have a unique purpose in no sense in having more categories. So I'm as confused by it as you are. If I could add a little more, I think, you know, the one of the challenges that we face sometimes as a state is each of the federal agencies within Interior, the bureaus within Interior, has specific missions mandated. BLM is supposed to be a multi-use agency. Fish and Wildlife Service really has a very limited charter. It's to protect wildlife, pretty much, and to provide habitat and to deal with ESA. The Park Service is to protect the values of a park. You know, that you're supposed to preserve its core ecosystems, its values, but allow people into that infrastructure. So very, very different purposes for these things. Bureau of Reclamation is supposed to provide water to people, as well as flood safety and manage dams. So when you look at these missions, they are very specific to that organization. So when you look at Interior and whole, the land classification really matters about how they approach it. And how, or risks they take with its management and how they balance those issues. So with BLM, you would expect a strong multi-use piece of collaboration with that. And sometimes it occurs and sometimes it doesn't. And so some of these more restrictive titles you would sort of expect out of the Fish and Wildlife Service, but you would expect less of it out of BLM. And I think there's a crossover of agency missions or a collapsing of those standards. And I think that's a dialogue. I've already started that dialogue. I've met with the BLM director in D.C. I've met with the deputy secretary and the chief of staff of the secretary. And we talked about some common ground issues. And I challenged them on some of these issues. And I said, let's look at what you want and what we want, and let's work together to try to resolve some of these issues at a professional level. And they were amenable to it in the initial conversations. So rather than having an external fight, rhetorical fight, I want to get inside because I know these agencies. I know they have a lot of really good people in there, and really see if we can problem solve and try to get the answers rather than you know, have a knockdown, dragdown fight. Again, I'm an apolitical guy. I just want to go in there and say, okay, this is what we need. This is what you need. Let's figure out how can we work this in an acceptable way. And I'm somewhat optimistic. The first conversations were very, very good. They know me. I know a bunch of them, and maybe we can be successful.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to qualify this with saying that I very seldom talk on confirmation nominees unless I don't feel that they're qualified. That's not the case today. I will talk about Dr. Meyer because he was one of the first people I met when I came to Juneau almost 15 years ago. I've known him professionally and personally that time, and I found him to be one of the most accessible and responsive of anybody that works for the state, if not the most responsive and accessible. What really impressed me was spending a couple days in D.C. After he got appointed to USGS. I hope he corrects me if I'm wrong, but I believe at that point in time he had three floors of one of his buildings that was full of people working strictly on Alaska issues. I have never seen so many qualified people, enthusiastic people, geeks, whatever. I'm sure they were making half as much working for the feds as they could have made in the private sector, but the enthusiasm was mind-boggling. Mark's greatest talents are that he's a real good eye for talent, and he generates enthusiasm in his workforce. And you know where I'm at now.
You're not required to respond to that. I'm just going to smile.
Thank you.
Tell us how you really feel.
That'll be the only time you probably see it through the rest of the podcast.
And Rep. Nagia.
Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Myers. And I think I've crossed over the years since you've been working in the different fields of expertise you have. And I've always found that you wanted to give the people the information they need to make the decisions that that will be made either by the local municipality or by the state. So thank you very much for that. And I echo the comments made by previous commenters about the experience you have, and I agree wholeheartedly with the words already expressed, and you make that comment about the wilderness and the Tsetsik Nation. in the place where I was born. And I've said it over the past several years that Congress makes a decision, not an agency. And the agency in this case has usurped the power of Congress by quasi-designating an area as a wilderness. And so I was happy to hear your comments, almost similar to what I think is happening. So thank you very much for this, and I hope to, if appointed, I hope that we will continue on that same vein as if you were to be the commissioner of natural resources. And I know we will if you were. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Chairman Tallarico. Dr. Myers, there are a couple of legal cases that went to the Supreme Court that I was tracking over the last few years that involved DNR. One was a decision brought by the tribe in Non-Dalton about land classification in the Western Interior. And Justice Stowers brought that back and said the department should have invited more public participation and there's been a reclassification. A second decision was in Superior Court, and that was involved the Chutna River and the watershed. And as we speak, there's comment being taken and consideration of the water rights application. In the second decision, Judge Widner almost held the agency in contempt. He threatened it with contempt for failure to process the applications and treat them as sort of a quasi-property interest. Is there a theme that you see in those, if I've read them right, that you're going to try and steer a different direction towards? I think I'm using too many prepositions. But at any rate, is there a theme that you see that you'd like to correct?
Thank you, Representative Josephson, to the chair. I don't know the law cases in great detail. I know the water reservation, went public, and I'm receiving lots and lots of public comments, both to me as commissioner, but also to the department on the water reservations. And clearly, I think DNR and talking with our water folks recognizes the need to have that public process on water reservations and that those rights do exist. So that process is ongoing. That said, we're going to adjudicate those very, very fairly. You know, if there's not a great concern for the fish in that or a way to work it or an economic evaluation piece of it, equation, that will be looked at within that evaluation. But it's an ongoing public process, so I'm not really comfortable because we're just receiving public comments into that. But clearly that's important. I think DNR has done what the courts asked them to, best I can tell. In terms of, I'd like to talk in the broader sense in terms of public process. You know, I was here for the issues surrounding shallow gas leasing and the need to reform that program and still retain the values of the values that were in there, try to find it as a sort of potential source of rural energy. And Rivers and Seat and I spent many days together, for example, working through the issues. And I think we reached a good resolution out of that. But it took a rewrite of the legislation because the legislation took out public process. So my experience in that, and I did a lot of the hearings and a lot of angry people in communities, including Homer, including the Valley. We were on the blunt end of very angry folks. And it was really not so much the program, but the lack of public input into the program. And so my experience has been, in that case, don't take out the public process. It's expensive. It takes time. But it's critical for the public process to work its way through the system and for people to be heard in the structure, and that to be confident that we have really followed the letter of the law when we make a decision. I'll give one other example. In May, the department's going to have another sale lands and state lands and waters in Bristol Bay. I was oil and gas director, and we worked through the process of having these sales in that area. We did it with a lot of public process. We went down, we worked with the native corporations, the tribal organizations, the communities, and we said, what do you need to protect? And we'll work with you. And there was great confidence in those communities for the state portion. So we have not gotten a lot of pushback in that time. We had a lease sale. We had environmental NGO come in and try to stop it, and the community told them, leave. We don't want you. So the fact is, if you do it right, if you do that upfront work in the right way, and you bring in the public protection and mitigation measures you need and accept that not 100% of what you want to lease is going to be leased, but a majority of it can be if you do it right, you reach those sorts of balances that are acceptable to communities. So I'm a big believer that we need that public process in there. We need that transparency. The challenge is if you have limited resources and you're pushed on time, it's where you want a shortcut because you just simply are running out of people and time. And it's not real fun to sit out in front of an angry group of people that disagree with the direction of the idea, but it's critical. It's critical, again, of the stewardship mission that DNR has. So as you said, I'm a big believer in the public process, both from experience, but also, again, just my personal belief structure.
Mm-hmm. Paulo?
Welcome. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Myers, it's great to have you here, and I'm so pleased to hear about your interest and emphasis on science-based policy. And one of the things that the governor has said is he's interested in additional collaboration opportunities with the university. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about that, having just come out of the position where you were working with the folks doing research. And I've been teaching at the university for a while and think that, you know, there's a lot of opportunities both for you know, substantive work that can be done and can be directly used for policy development, and then as part of the, you know, sort of pipeline of state workers, if you will, you know, to come in. I think we have, you know, sort of, you know, one need is for more research, and that's an affordable way to maybe accomplish it. And then a second need just to be building our workforce more, particularly as, you know, it becomes harder to compete with the opportunities in the private sector. So just wanted to hear your thoughts on what you might do going forward to address those two issues and be a stronger partner with the university.
Well, thank you, Representative Tarr, for the question to the chair. I could spend an hour on this alone, but I'll try to keep it short. At a fundamental level, you know, I think the state of Alaska, as it diversifies its economy, needs to bring in a R&D focus to the state. We have really opportunities and we have a unique environment, unique resources, an amazing opportunity with the Arctic to do high-tech development. The unmanned aerial vehicles are an example, the sensors for those. Those are a disruptive technology. They can really change the way we monitor the environment. We do public safety. We do resource assessment. So it's a huge set of tools. The university is the best, probably one of the best in the world using small unmanned aerial vehicles. We have the FAA test site. We have partnerships with all the folks in some very, very soon with some of the major companies in the world that do these things. So there's an opportunity to bring jobs in, to bring an industry in. We don't do enough with research park type collaboration, though. So I was working strongly to how do we do that? Where do we find those sweet spots? Power is another one. Microgrids and electrical power and generating power from combined renewable fossil fuel systems. University is really good. Their test lab facility is great at it. Understanding complex policy issues and then interfacing across boundaries that governments can't do, but industry, government, and NGOs can all meet in the same space in a university. We've had exceptional when I was there. We had 4 hours with the Secretary of Navy, and where do you get that kind of time? Coming up to Fairbanks, the head of NORTHCOM, NATO parliamentarians for NATO science and technology came to Fairbanks, and we spent a day and a half with them. So you start seeing these opportunities. The university is a different draw. It's a neutral ground, and there's so much technical capacity, and it's long term. It's there embedded in the structure. Also, between the universities is a tremendous amount of scientific research equipment. The state can't duplicate it all. In fact, I would say probably 90% of our scientific capacities in these universities in terms of microscopes, labs, engineering, high-tech engineering. And then finally, the university can be funded by sources the state can't be. The National Science Foundation is the biggest funder of research for our universities. And so you have this relationship on the pure science side that then can work with a NOAA and with the state or say on the application of that technology. So they play a sweet spot in providing that pure technology. Observing systems, the university has a tremendous capacity to download data from satellites and does. And so using that data with the state, the cooperative working relationship on the mapping, for example, the strategic mapping initiative with the federal government, the state is another place. And then finally, the state does have a state committee on research. That's co-chaired by the lieutenant governor and then usually the president of the university or the vice president for research and Academic Affairs. I co-chaired that for a while for the university along with Lieutenant Governor Treadwell. That is a very neat connection because that identifies the state's research needs and the university's capacity to do that research. It also validates research that requires a state endorsement for a federal grant. So it's a very effective collaboration tool, and I've already talked to Lieutenant Governor a lot about co-chairing that. And so I think that relationship can help build that. But in all these cases, from R&D, the cooperative, and then finally to education, graduate, both UAA and UAF have taken a real effort for undergraduate research. By training those undergraduates, they're learning critical thinking skills. They're going to be that much more valuable as employees. And then finally, the graduate students. We need trained PhDs in this state badly, and we need them to understand the Arctic issues and to stay in Alaska if we can keep them. So that university providing, we produce about 50 PhDs a year. Those guys are going to be future leaders if we can keep them in terms of science and technology. So that last training piece is really important. In the Arctic, University of Alaska is the lead institute in the world in terms of what it produces. In Arctic. So in our niche, we want to keep that niche vibrant.
Follow-up, Reptar? No. Any other questions from the committee?
Well, just one. Representative Josephson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Meiss, did I hear you say that it's within the power of the commissioner to make some adjustments to a mission statement, but a commissioner's not required to refer it, but you intended to? Is that what I... In other words, you were going to defer for some approval in any event?
I haven't gotten back a legal opinion. Historically... The belief has been it does require legislative approval of a change of mission statement. However, Commissioner Sullivan's mission statement stands, and there was no approval process. So that's where it sits. So I've asked for clarification on that. I said, regardless of where that decision goes, I would like to come back to the body because I believe, you know, if you write the checks and control the budget and write the laws, we ought to be accountable and responsible to you.
Well, just I haven't personally written a check yet, but I'm told they're written. So.
Any other questions from the committee?
Just one other.
Oh, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one last one that I found encouraging from the transition team report. And just I think this will be something I bring up with the next person as well. But there was a recommendation about develop a formal training for conductor of public hearings. And I just wonder, it seems like in some of the more controversial decision-making bodies, like you know, some of the boards that are making these resource allocation decisions, that we might benefit from, you know, having those folks a little better trained, or just being able to manage those difficult meetings a little bit better, and what you might do to accomplish that.
I'm going to talk to the chair. I concur with that wholeheartedly. It's not just facilitation skills. It's understanding how adaptive management works and structured decision-making works and finding out a method that works and that works for the state. It's a very difficult thing to do in practice. There are wonderful handbooks out there, but there are very few people that can actually organizations that succeed unless there's a win-win situation. And often there isn't. In the case of not a win-win situation, it hasn't been successful. It should be. It's the way of the future, clearly, because we have to deal with the uncertainty in these decisions. But training people, both in structured decision-making. There are some programs like MIT. I sponsored one. USGS Director sponsored a program and seconded people to a program that did that at MIT. And so there are a few folks that have attempted to teach it. Right now in the university, I think there's an opportunity. We teach some of the fundamentals of it. I would also say I'd like to see us continue to develop our natural resource manager programs. Mm-hmm. Because for DNR, that's a major workforce for us, and it's important that we train to the standards the state really needs, and sometimes those programs have had less than full enrollments, yet it's an important field. And that would involve that to the public process and then how to do structured decision-making effectively.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Myers, with Commissioner Cotton behind you, and I understand I was sort of just seeing these articles in the newspaper and practicing law, but about a decade ago there was a discussion, more than discussion and concern, about your department sort of usurping some of the role that traditionally was played by Fish and Game. Can you give us a sense of what you think happened and how you perceive that relationship?
Representative Justin, through the chair, it had to deal, I believe, with the Habitat Division, placement of the Habitat Division by Governor Murkowski into DNR versus being traditionally a fishing game. And my experience going back from being the oil and gas director all the way forward is that relationship between habitat, DNR, and fishing game has at times worked very well. Other times it's been very challenging, often based on the personality of the directors of the organizations and the willingness to elevate decisions. There were times when there was clearly an antagonistic relationship, and that led to constant elevation of issues. So I think when Governor Murkowski looked at it, he believed that putting it within DNR would better align the two. In some ways, I think, as long as it maintains its core habitat values in the system, I think it could work fine. But there was never trust, I think, in that decision in many in the wildlife community. And so I'm not saying that there were any actions in particular, but just the appearance of it not being a fishing game led to a challenge. There's no perfect answer to that question, I don't think, because a lot of the land management, the resource management, other than the wildlife, is the habitat for the wildlife is largely in DNR. But the wildlife themselves are in Fish and Wildlife. So no perfect answer. The best is to have a real strong collaboration between at the director level of these agencies to work through the issues and to promote science-based management. I will say there have been years when I was oil and gas director that I was frustrated the habitat folks didn't seem to be using enough science in their decision or have enough data to support the conclusions they had reached, and I challenged them on it as oil and gas director. And I usually won those challenges. But I shouldn't come to that. You should have that data ahead of time. You should invest in the data to make good habitat decisions. So again, I think science-based management really will alleviate that as long as it's not a personality fight between the organizations or an internal bureaucratic struggle. And I don't. I certainly think as long as Sam Cotton is our fishing game commissioner, I don't see those things happening between us.
Thank you.
Is that a safe line?
Any further questions from the committee? No? Seeing none? Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Meyer. We appreciate that you coming before us today. And I want to mention that your previous experience with the National Guard and the Air Force Reserve means a lot to a guy like me. I know that consumes a lot of time, and that's quite a commitment from anyone. So I certainly appreciate that as part of your actually very impressive resume, sir. So thank you. We'll let you out of the hot seat,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And at this time, I'd like to open public testimony on the confirmation. And I'd like to know if there's anyone present who would like to testify at all. Well, seeing none, do we have anyone at the LIOs? No. And no off-net testimony. Okay. Well, at this time, I will close public testimony. Thank you. And I would like to entertain a motion, if I could.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we advance Lane Mark Myers for Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources to the joint session, recognizing that signing the report does not indicate a affirmative or a negative vote on that final confirmation.
Thank you very much, Representative Johnson. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, that motion is adopted. We will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork and then move to our next item on the agenda. House Resource Committee, come back to order at 1:56. And moving down our agenda, I'd like to ask our Commissioner Designee, Mr. Sam Cotton, to please come forward and speak to us a little bit. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now, one of the things, Mr. Cotton, and I don't have all of the exact dates. I know that you have served before, and would you just let us know what your service was here as a legislator, please?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It was actually 40 years ago, I was a freshman legislator in this body, and I served 14 years in the House and two in the Senate. First elected in '74. So my first session was 40 years ago, and my last session was 1992. And if you'd like, I could give you a little bit of background here and look forward to questions you might have and look forward to working with this committee. I suspect we may see each other again here as legislation proceeds. I was born a couple blocks from here and grew up mostly in Palmer and Eagle River. I'm married, have two sons in their 20s, After high school, I went in the military, did a couple tours of duty in Vietnam. And as I mentioned earlier, I've had a little experience working on the other side of the table here, but being in the executive branch is new to me. I've had some other government experience, but certainly not in this capacity. My personal life, I do a lot of fishing. I'm a sport fisherman. I've participated in a lot of personal use fisheries, and I also had a limited entry purse seine permit for Lower Cook Inlet, so I was a commercial fisherman for about 25 years. My kids do that now. They promoted me to admiral, and they're doing the fishing these days. As far as background that might be relevant to being Commissioner of Fish and Game, I worked for several years for a local government, the Oceans East Borough, and as a resource analyst, and we worked on a variety of issues, including oil and gas. There was some lease sales out that way that we were involved in, and actually the local government was in support of them, which put them in contrast with adjoining local governments, but got a real feel for local involvement there. We also did a lot of work on special area plans, and I know that's one of the functions of the Department of Natural Resources in the Habitat Division is to deal with special area plans like critical habitat areas. So again, as I worked with the local government, I was involved with developing a management plan for one of the critical habitat areas. And you may know that the legislature creates critical habitat areas, and then the department is assigned to put together a management plan for those. And sometimes they sit for quite a long time. In fact, the one I worked on was first created, I think, in 1980. And a couple of years ago, it finally got around to where it's turned to have a management plan. And it was a pretty interesting experience to, we had maybe a half a dozen meetings and a lot of public participation about what would be compatible, what the existing local uses are. So it gave me a real feel for how important the public process was. And now we're waiting to see what kind of budgetary resources we're going to have to continue. But if there are revisions to special area plans, there's going to be full public participation in those in the development of those plans. And I think the difference, perhaps, in this in the last year or so was that when you develop a brand new plan, there's an automatic public process. But when you review or revise a plan, there's some choices to be made there. But our choice would be to fully involve the public in any, especially major revisions. One of the other things that I worked on, probably the primary job working for the local government, was dealing with fisheries issues. So I spent a lot of time going to Board of Fish meetings, the North Pacific Council meetings, and the local government at the Aleutians East Borough, the fishery there is the Area M fishery, and it's pretty well known to a lot of other fisheries because they usually got blamed for being the reason that the other fisheries weren't doing well. It's a mixed stock fishery. It's strategically located near the end of the Alaska Peninsula, so a lot of other fish that are heading someplace else go through there. So I got to know a lot about Bristol Bay. I got to know a lot about Western Alaska, the river fisheries, Norton Sound, Kodiak, Chignik. So it was a good education to work in that area, and again, get well informed on many other fisheries. My work on the North Pacific Council, I went to a lot of meetings, and then I was appointed to the council, served two terms, and I'm back on there now as the Commissioner of Fish and Game. The state has 6 of the 11 voting seats on the council. The Commissioner of Fish and Game is one of those seats. The other 5 are what are referred to as discretionary seats that the governor nominates and the Secretary of Commerce appoints. But we do have a majority, and it's important that as much as possible, we work together. We don't have to be in lockstep, but there's a lot of issues that affect Alaskans, and so that's a big part of the focus that we concentrate on there. There's a lot of opportunities to ensure that Alaskan fishermen, Alaska fishing communities are protected and are given fair treatment, and it's a never-ending battle in some cases. The Seattle fleets refer to themselves as their distant water fleets, and they've enjoyed fishing in Alaska for probably a century or more. And In fact, the majority of the fish caught between 3 and 200 miles are caught by people that don't live here. But they're often landed or processed or transferred within the state's jurisdiction. So they impact our communities and our economy. As we all know, the fishing industry is, I believe it's the largest employer in Alaska. So those issues consume a lot of a lot of my time and my energy, and will continue to do so. One of the pleasant, I guess it wasn't really a surprise, but I've really been happy to find that as I've gotten acquainted with a lot of people at the department, the level of professionalism, the people that work there, for the most part, they are scientists, biologists, have a strong science background. And this is the work they want to do. They went to school to get these kind of jobs, and they enjoy their work, and they're very good at it, and get a lot of recognition for the outstanding work that they do. So it's a huge responsibility that we have at the Department to the people of Alaska. A lot of people depend on us to do a good job so that they can have access to the resources, the fish and game resources. Obviously, they're sometimes get a little political, or there's some allocation battles. But as long as we have, as long as we can do a good job of protecting and maintaining and managing our resources on a sustained yield basis, I think we'll continue to be able to provide good access to people in Alaska. We have a lot of challenges. Working with the federal government presents a lot of challenges. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park Service, other agencies often remind us that they have different mission statements than do we. So we have to do our best to work with them, and we sometimes end up in court as well. The whole issue of polarization is one that I'd like to try to improve. I think we can do that with better communications, spending more time in the communities, working with people that are involved. The Board of Fish and Board of Game process offers a pretty good opportunity for people to participate, but the department needs to make a very strong effort, too, with outreach and make sure that people understand why we're doing things, how we're making decisions. And I'm not going to be critical of previous efforts, but I'm sure we can always do better at that. So I'll rest there, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Questions from the committee?
Sure.
Representative Josephson and Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, the transition team spoke to a fish-first policy. I assume you've read that. I know it's not binding on you. I assume it's not. But is that something that you subscribe to? First, could you define it as you see it, and is it something you would subscribe to?
Well, it's my impression that referring to the sustained yield process, that we're going to take a scientific approach. We're going to make sure that tomorrow's fish is more important than today's. That we will allow harvest on a continuous basis, but recognizing that the fish come first. That sustained yield is a constitutional mandate.
Okay, thank you,
Representative Herron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, of course, you chaired this committee in this very room many years ago. What's the same and what's different from where we were, the legislature was dealing with fish and game as they are today? What do you see that's both different and the same?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, some things never change. There's always going to be a lot of passion about fish and game issues, so I don't see any change there. One thing I've seen a big change in is the demographics of Alaska. Many years ago that I was here, the population was a little different, so you had a lot more legislators that represented fishing communities. Commercial fishing communities in southeast, southwest, just around the state. There were just more people that were fishermen in the legislature, and that's not necessarily not necessarily bad now, but I think that there's sometimes challenges to impressing upon people the importance of sustainable fishing communities. So those of you that do represent fishing communities probably understand that challenge as well. The population in South Central Alaska has put greater demands on salmon resources, especially in Cook Inlet. So there's an increase in interest in personal use fisheries, and it's I think that's been pretty well received. I think people are, you know, recognize that. I think the department's recognized that food for individuals is very important. I mean, we've recognized subsistence as a priority, and personal use is growing in popularity.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. Also, welcome, Commissioner Cotton. Also, in the transition report, there was a statement about there should be no significant loss of fish habitat knowingly permitted in the state of Alaska. And just wondering if you can comment on any current projects or how that objective might be accomplished by the department.
Thank you. Well, habitat, and I think that the previous commissioner spoke a little bit about some of those issues, but there's a couple of issues that are surfacing now with the Tuitna coal mine, for is a good example, and there's a habitat issue is going to be involved there. And I spoke to the Resource Development Council the other day, and I'll try to give the same answer to you that I gave to them, that one of my primary jobs is to protect fish. And so I think that we start out with that mission, and we're going to do our best job at that. But we have to be objective. We have to look at people that come in and apply for Title 16 permits. We can't have our mind made up in advance. That's not really a fair way to approach things. So, I come from a mining family. My dad came to Alaska in 1928 as a gold miner, so I still see a little bit of romance in mining. But at the same time, there's going to be some major challenges to try to convince this department that I want to be careful how I say this, but we have to be sure that we're not taking chances on our fishery habitat.
Mm-hmm. Representative Nagy.
I was looking at your white tail. I saw the Legislative Conservation Award to you in 1988 by the Wildlife Federation of Alaska, and in the same year the Alaska Outdoor Council Special Recognition Award. Having been a board vice chair of the Board of Game, I mean, having heard both sides argue on a lot of issues, boy, that's quite an accomplishment.
Thank you.
I won't have you respond to that one either, but thank you. Representative Olson?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you for joining us today. One question only. Where does traditional knowledge fit into the big picture?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, traditional knowledge is important, and even as a sport fisherman myself, I'm often I have found myself in the past complaining to managers that they didn't pay attention to people that spend a lot of time out on the lakes and streams, and I suspect that's true everywhere you go. There's a lot of value in traditional knowledge. So obviously science has to be the primary driver, but if we ignore traditional knowledge, that we're making a mistake.
Follow up?
Professor Olson.
The only reason I ask is the only place that I've really seen it used, I don't know if I want to say effectively or extensively or both, but would be Red Dog Mine, where they consult the elders on the caribou passages at various times of the year, where they do get formal input. But I guess that wasn't a question, that was a statement. Yeah.
Any other questions? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The North Pacific Fisheries Management Council manages the federal waters 3 to 200. I mean, you served on the council, obviously, you know. When I, back in the 90s, was going there, we had a real problem with net loss fisheries. Basically, rock sole fishery, trawl fishery was killing more value for the United States in crab and halibut than it was harvesting. And at that time, there was this feeling by the council that the if there was any economic value, then they were required to conduct the fishery. And, you know, I talked to Ted Stevens directly, and he said, oh, that's not correct. You know, you just need to go ahead and not do those things. I was wondering your opinion on net loss fisheries and the bycatch issues. If we have a fishery that is actually destroying more value from fisheries through bycatch of other species than it's actually net harvesting, do you feel that the council is required to continue with that kind of a fishery?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Seaton, the answer is no. There, as you're probably familiar, there are 10 national standards that the council is required to consider when making those types of decisions. And number one is that we should try to allow for optimum yield, which is the fishery, the rock sole or the elephant sole fishery, for example. But there's another national standard that says we should reduce bycatch as much as practicable. And so there's a balance that you often face yourselves, but that's what we face. A good recent example is in the Bering Sea, there's about there's a limit as to how much halibut bycatch can be taken, but there's also a limit as to overall halibut removals. And this last year, it looked like they were about the same. The allowed removal was going to equal the bycatch, so therefore the people who lived in the Pribilofs and any other Alaskan fishermen that wanted to go fishing for halibut in the Bering Sea were told, sorry, there's very little left for you. It all got used in bycatch. And it's a difficult thing for, so we took action and petitioned the Secretary for Emergency Response and visited the Halibut Commission and pretty aggressively chased after that. So, in fact, in June, our next meeting is actually in April, but in the June meeting this year, we're going to take final action on that to significantly reduce the bycatch allowance for those trawl fisheries. You do have to find a balance, but that was getting ridiculous.
Representative Seaton?
And thank you, and I hope, you know, we're trying to get through the congressional delegation just to clarify that you're not obligated to conduct a fishery if there's an economic value to it, if it's destroying more than not, but I'm glad to hear that you are looking at that, and I hope we look at those fisheries that might be in those problem statements and let the fishermen know that, you know, if they are operating in those conditions, they risk losing access there. Another thing that we've looked at in the state here, there's the king salmon problem, and the Sustainable Salmon Initiative. I went to several of their meetings that was looking at the Yukon-Kuskokwim, and they were identifying seven different theories of what might be happening and then going out and collecting data to actually test those theories, doing science. And, you know, I've been somewhat concerned that Fish and Game has looked at Cook Inlet and done a gap analysis, not testing any theories, but said, what don't we know, and going out collect some information there, but we never eliminate anything because all we're doing is gaining information. Are you going to proceed on the initiative of testing scientific theories and saying, okay, what do we need what information do we need to gather to prove or disprove this theory so that we can move on and find out information? Or is Fish and Game going to be proposing research that, well, we don't know that, so we'll collect some information on it instead of testing theories?
That's a difficult, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Seaton, that's a difficult question. We still have some funding remaining that the legislature gave the Department for Chinook Salmon Research, and it's an extremely high priority for the department to conduct that research and learn what we can. We've had, in the Bering Sea, it's quite a different story than in the Gulf of Alaska. In the Bering Sea, the Chinook salmon that are involved in the bycatch up there are primarily Alaska fish. In the Gulf of Alaska, the most recent genetic study suggests that at least the bycatch fish are probably 95% not central or western Alaska, but primarily British Columbia, Washington, and some southeast fish. So you have two different scenarios there as far as the makeup of the stocks in the Gulf of Alaska versus the Bering Sea. But universally, it appears that for some reason in Alaska waters, the marine survival of a juvenile is suffering. And so it isn't one particular river system, but it's that early time in the marine environment that we suspect that they're having low survival rates. So we want to direct some attention to that, and at the same time, it's we're not certain. The best scientists will tell you the problem is it's ocean conditions. And that means a whole lot of different possibilities. So none of them have been proven, but we want to continue to test them. I'm not sure if I was responsive to your question there, but we do have Chinook salmon research and as a high priority.
And I guess the thing that I've seen is that when the Bering Sea Sustainable Salmon Initiative was there, it was doing science. It was saying, okay, what theories do we have that, you know, and they came up with, I think, seven of them, of what theories do we have that is retarding king salmon coming back to the river or dying in the river and those things. And then they went out with RFPs to collect data to prove or disprove those theories. And yet, when Fish and Game was designing their gap analysis for the Cook Inlet area, they just came out and said, well, what do we know? And so we'll collect some information, but there's no proving or disproving of a theory. And so there's no way you move on to saying, oh, that condition that we thought might be there was disproven. So I hope, as Commissioner, you'll make sure that the people, when they're collecting doing research and spending the dollars that we allocate, are actually doing science and either looking at proving or disproving a theory instead of just saying we're going to collect some information, because it's very difficult to continue supporting research when the research is going to maybe generate some information, but you're not going to come out with any answers from the information. And so that's, I hope that you'll be a real stickler in the department to say, why are we collecting this information? What will it prove or disprove to make sure that we're doing science? So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't mean to go on quite so long, but that was an answer to what I was trying to get to in the question.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from the committee? Oh, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now that we're just thinking, talking with some of the North Pacific issue, Fisheries Management Council issues, and just thinking of the reauthorization of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, now that Senator Begich isn't there, and I'm told Representative Young now will sort of be taking the lead, and, you know, there were just some things that were going to be under consideration for personal use in terms of management, and what will your involvement be as that effort goes forward, and how that might impact overall management for the state.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, Representative, we are watching that closely. We've seen and I've read the most recent proposal that Representative Young's advanced in legislation, and it's not that much different than what has been on the table before. There's some new language about membership on the council as far as perhaps a subsistence seat as well as a recreational seat, but there are no designated seats, but I think they use language to encourage participation by a variety of user groups. Mm-hmm. That's early in the process here, so there's a lot of interest in tweaks that people would like to see, different user groups would like to see, so we are going to pay very close attention to that, as does the council itself. So the council and the department are paying very close attention to that legislation.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Commissioner Quinn, you and I have discussed wildlife issues some, and I wanted you to sort of explain your perception of the give and take and comedy, I think is the legal word, but basically mutual respect as you
see it should be shown between federal wildlife policy, which would prohibit intensive game management, and Alaska's policy. Could you sort of give some explanation of that as you see that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, and that's a good point as far as contrast between National Park Service, for example, and the Department of Fish and Game and Alaska statutes that direct intensive management activities. The goal in Alaska often is on an intensive management program is to reduce predators because you want to improve the opportunity to for consumptive users. And a good example is the department just finished some predator control in northern part of Alaska here to reduce wolf populations and near some villages that depend on moose for food. And the problem that I've had with the National Park Service is a difference of understanding of what you're trying to accomplish there. First meeting I had with the National Park Service, they suggested that they didn't much care for Alaska's game farming. And I kind of got taken back by that, but it displayed an attitude that I think they had that suggested maybe we were trying to raise trophy animals behind a fence so that sport hunters could bag a big one. I was really surprised to hear that term and that lack of understanding as to what Alaska's goals were. But we're statutorily required, as the Board of Game is, to participate in intensive management activities, which also can mean habitat manipulation, but that gets a little scary at times if you're thinking about controlled burns and things that might have unintended consequences, but reduction of primarily bears and wolves in areas where consumptive use is very important to people.
Any further questions?
Sure. In that realm, there are a lot of practices that are permitted primarily over the last 20 years that were unknown to Alaska in the 70s and 80s, for example. Do you see that as just a shift in Alaska culture and acceptance of those practices, or the fact that population's grown so we need more prey, or... I mean, there really is sort of a divide that follows the intensive game management law. Is there something you can expound on there that describes that?
Well, maybe you're thinking about something specific like baiting brown bears.
And snaring. And
snaring, yeah. That's one thing that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service will not allow in their preserve units. And in fact, it really hasn't been a very successful part of the Alaska Intensive Game Management program, the brown bear baiting. I mean, you're able to accomplish the goal if you are to bring a bear over to bait, but as far as an effective tool for reducing those predator populations, it hasn't been that effective. In fact, I don't really think it's being employed now. There may have been a permit or two in the last few years, but there are other more efficient ways to accomplish those goals. But that's one of the things that what they call denning. Although they suggest that they may let some federally qualified subsistence users go ahead and do the denning, but one of the things they got really concerned about was using flashlights. Now, I tell you what, I'm not interested personally in learning about denning, because what it amounts to is you crawl down in the hole, and if there's a bear down there, you dispatch it. But meanwhile, you've got your friend holding on to your ankles, and you know, if you start kicking, I think he's supposed to pull you back out. But it just doesn't seem like a practice that's probably being employed very often. But it's one of the methods that they've singled out as one that they don't condone.
Any other questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, because we've had such a warm year, you know, warmest year on record low snowfall, are there any management decisions you see in the near term here that will have to be in response in response to that, or anything that we're doing in a sort of emergency way?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. I mean, I suspect we'll have some water levels that may be lower than normal, but I'm pretty sure that I don't know what I would do about that. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, and then the the fire danger would be another issue that wouldn't be our department, but I think that the state government's going to have some responsibility to deal with those things. But I guess I haven't.
But not for the denning animal. You know, there's just been some discussion about whether any of these animals are going to be coming out of hibernation early, or what it's going to, lack of food is going to mean if they do, you know, because then they'll be in, ahead of the, you know, regular growth, seasonal growth for the vegetative plants that they would be living on?
I'm afraid I'm not able to give much of an answer on that. I know a lot of, it seemed like a lot of bears were late to hibernate this year, and there have been other amazing weather factors that have affected game populations this year. Both caribou and sheep, when they have the rain and at the wrong time of the year, and then it freezes up in the, like in the Brooks Range, for example, the food that the sheep eat are now under ice, and there's been some pretty steep declines in populations there, and the same with the couple of the Arctic caribou herds. So I'm not sure it's been conclusively determined, but there's some food issues involved with weather-related incidents there as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Mr. Cotton, thank you very much. We appreciate your time and your coming in to speak to us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And we will move to public testimony on this confirmation. I wonder if there is anyone present that would like to testify. Seeing none, we'll go to the LIOs. Jessica, do we have this one right here? Okay, great. So we'll go to, I guess we're in Anchorage, and go to Ernie Wise. Mr. Wise, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we certainly can. Please give us your name for the record and 3-minute testimony.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ernie Wise. I live in Anchorage. I'm employed by the Aleutians East Borough as the Director of Natural Resources Department. I am here representing the Aleutians East Borough. On behalf of Mayor Stanley Mack and the Borough Assembly, we'd like to voice our strong support for Sam Cotton as Commissioner of Fish and Game. As you've heard, Sam is a former fisheries analyst for the borough, and of course he has a long history of public service and leadership in the state. We believe Sam has the right experience, breadth of knowledge, and the ability to lead the department and manage our state's fish and game resources for the benefit of all Alaskans. Speaking personally, I've had the privilege of working fairly closely with Mr. Cotton for the past 4 years. Sam has been a mentor to me and a good friend. So to keep it brief for the borough and myself, we would urge you to vote to confirm Commissioner Cotton. Appreciate the opportunity to comment, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Weiss. Does the committee have any questions? thank you for your testimony. We appreciate that. Do we have anyone else, Jessica, at the LIOs or off-net? No? No one at all? Okay. Well, we will close public testimony. Thank you very much. I wonder, are there any other committee comments before we move ahead? I would entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to say that the denning seems to be like a hunter control as opposed to a bear control. You can get it from hunters. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Resource Committee has reviewed the qualification of the following governor's appointee and recommends that his name be forwarded to the joint session for consideration. Commissioner Department, Fish and Game, Sam Cotton. This does not reflect the intent by any member to vote either for or against the individual during the session for the purpose of confirmation.
Thank you very much. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. We're going to take a brief at ease so we can sign the paperwork, and we will come back to adjourn. The Resource Committee will come back to order at 2:33, and we don't have any other business before the committee. Any comments committee members would like to make? Seeing none, we are adjourned at 2:33.